Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Just to let you all know, I'm going to get into the debate and the fight between House Speaker Pelosi and President Trump and the government shutdown. We're going to deal with all of those issues tomorrow. But right now, President Nicolas Maduro today faced the gravest challenge to his authority since assuming power in 2013 as the leader of the U.S.-backed opposition, Juan Guaido, claimed the mantle of leadership, and President Trump and other world leaders from Canada, Brazil, Colombia, Paraguay, and the Organization of American States promptly recognized him as Venezuela's interim and rightful head of state. All of this, even though President Nicolas Maduro is still the democratically elected president of Venezuela. A defiant Maduro responded by announcing a break in diplomatic and political relations with the United States and ordering American diplomats to leave the country within 72 hours. U.S. officials said they are rushing personnel out of Caracas. Here is the audio from a video that Vice President Mike Pence released yesterday.
Hola, I'm Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States. And on behalf of President Donald Trump and all the American people, let me express the unwavering support of the United States as you, the people of Venezuela, raise your voices in a call for freedom. Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. He's never won the presidency in a free and fair election, and he's maintained his grip of power by imprisoning anyone who dares to oppose him. The United States joins with all freedom-loving nations in recognizing the National Assembly as the last vestige of democracy in your country, for it's the only body elected by you, the people. As such, the United States supports the courageous decision by Juan Guaido, the President of your National Assembly, to assert that body's constitutional powers, declare Maduro a usurper, and call for the establishment of a transitional government. As you make your voices heard tomorrow, on behalf of the American people, we say to all the good people of Venezuela, estamos con ustedes. We are with you. We stand with you. And we will stay with you until democracy is restored and you reclaim your birthright of libertad. Muchas gracias y vayan con Dios.
It would be laughable if it weren't so serious. What does this mean for Venezuela? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. First, he holds the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston and is one of the most prolific writers of our time, Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, as always, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are also joined by the former director of the King Center in Atlanta, former dean of the African American Studies Department at Ohio University, Tom Porter. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined via Skype by a veteran grassroots organizer whose roots are in the Black Liberation Movement and anti-apartheid and Central American solidarity struggles. He was the Green Party vice presidential candidate in the 2016 election, Ajamu Baraka. Welcome back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So for each of you, I'll start with Dr. Horn. Before we get into the specifics of these events, your overall thoughts when you heard that Juan Guaido swore himself as President Maduro's interim replacement.
Very ominous and dangerous turn of events. I have to say that I'm disappointed, particularly with the government of Canada, which has had its prime minister bullied by Mr. Trump. And yet Canada is joining in to this Yankee scheme. I don't think they realize that times are changing and that U.S. imperialism is trying to change the calculus with regard to its so-called allies. That is to say, to try to convert them into vassal states, just like it's going to try to convert Venezuela into a vassal state. I'm not surprised by the fact that Brazil, under Mr. Bolsonaro, has endorsed this tawdry maneuver, since Mr. Bolsonaro, in some ways, is to the right of Mr. Trump. However, it seems to me that we should realize, number one, that if Venezuela is allowed to be intimidated by Washington, next on the list will not only be Cuba, which, of course, is Venezuela's close ally, but also probably the left-leaning government in Mexico as well. But on the larger horizon, I think part of the problem is that with this so-called Make America Great Again movement that propelled Mr. Trump into office in November 2016, the question ever has been, who is going to be looted in order to satisfy and sate the rapacious Trump base? It appears that Venezuela is at the top of the list.
Tom Porter, your thoughts, and to Gerald's point about Canada, you know, we were surprised, I think we were surprised, when Trudeau went along with the arrest of the Huawei CEO, and now we've got Trudeau going along with the Venezuela move. Trudeau is surprising me.
Well, it is, and it really isn't. I mean, Trudeau has shown himself to be a right-winger in liberal clothes. So that doesn't surprise me. But what I think it really points to, if I was an American who believed in America, I'd be concerned, because this does not bode well for America. After all, what Pence was talking about was the destruction of the legitimate government of Venezuela, which is the same thing that Trump and his allies say when they want to destroy the deep state. So what we have, and it's Venezuela, as Dr. Horn said, probably Cuba, probably Mexico if they can. The problem with these moves that they're making, are the people in Brazil better off under this new government? The answer is no. Every place, every government they've overthrown, or every regime change that they've ushered in, the people were worse off than they were before. And the same will be true in Venezuela, because Venezuela is having problems because of the sanctions, because of U.S. intrigue, and what have you. Whoever comes to power is going to have the same problem. That is, cannot satisfy the basic human needs of the people.
Same question, Ajamu. And adding to Tom's point about governments that the United States overthrows, the people wind up being worse off. That just reminds me of surveys taken in Iraq after Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and Iraqis saying, hands down, please bring him back.
Well, you're absolutely right. Both yourself and Tom, that has always been the consequence. But you know, this is a very serious moment, and the consequences of this intervention on the part of the U.S. For the people of Venezuela is quite grave, not only for the people of Venezuela, but also for the people in this region. The kind of support that this slow coup, if you will, has received in Latin America and from other parts of the world, Canada being included, makes the situation quite different than the coup of 2002. And it's quite ominous that with this move by the Trump administration, we have not seen much pushback from progressive and left forces in the United States of America. So all of this sort of makes this situation even more serious for the real possibility of something dramatic happening in Venezuela. And that's something that's really troubling for me as I'm watching this drama unfold.
Tom, to Ajamu's point, as we look at this rise in so-called progressives, particularly on the Democratic side, one of the things that is conspicuously absent is the discussion about militarism, American militarism, and whether it's a pushback on the military budget, whether it's a pushback on its actual aggression, whether it be Yemen, whether it be Syria, whether it be Turkey, whether it now be Venezuela, the so-called liberals are conspicuously silent.
Well, the dominant ideology and philosophy in American politics today is American exceptionalism. And, you know, that is that America has the right and responsibility to rule the world. And if people would not accept you're ruling the world, then you'll have to do what you're doing in Venezuela, which you'll probably try and do in Cuba, and which you have already done in Brazil. That's what you do. But in the long run, I don't think they'll be successful. I think in Venezuela, I'm not really sure what Maduro's going to do, but I think that he's going to have to resist. I think he's going to organize the people to fight back, because the United States is not playing. They're not only talking about removing him from power and putting somebody else in his place, but in the final analysis, we have the lesson of Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. They intend to take him off the planet. So on the other hand, in this country, progressives have got to step up, which they have not done. We can't expect a Democratic Party. There's no essential difference, and we know that, and it's said over and over again, between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. But there is a realignment of forces inside of this country, and we hope that some people will step up inside of this country right now and speak up, particularly on the left.
Gerald, who is Juan Guaido, and how has he come to the forefront as the leader of the National Assembly?
Well, he's the latest in a series of puppets who have been brought forth by U.S. imperialism in Caracas in order to take the place of Mr. Maduro. I don't think that that will succeed, but I do think we need to step back for a second and try to look at this situation from 35,000 feet. And what we see is that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States thought that it would be ruling the planet forevermore, but it forgot about the fact that it had cut a deal with Beijing in order to bring down the Soviet Union, which led to massive foreign direct investment in China, which created this unstoppable juggernaut. And so now the New York Times columnist, Roger Cohen, has said that there are two books that define the present moment: Crazy Rich Asians and Hillbilly Elegy. Crazy Rich Asians, of course, turned into a movie about the wealth that's flowed into Asia, Singapore, and China in particular, and Hillbilly Elegy, talking about the devastation that has taken place in Appalachia, or Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky. And so when Mr. Trump in 2015-16 talks about Make America Great Again, what he's talking about is who is going to be looted, who is going to be plundered in order to sate the base of the Republican Party. Now, we all know that whatever promises and pledges are made, that the only ones who will be satisfied will be those at the top of the pyramid, not those in Appalachia. But in any case, that has been the promise. It seems to me that this is doomed to failure, that we are walking into a catastrophe with this new Trump move towards Venezuela. Recall that he had to be talked down from the ledge some months ago when he was talking about a military intervention in Venezuela. Venezuela now has broken diplomatic relations with the United States of America. The U.S. diplomats will be exiting within the next 72 hours. This situation is hurtling towards a fiasco.
Ajamu, Juan Guaido, in the context of his mentor, Leopoldo López, and how the United States fits in into fanning these flames and encouraging and supporting this political opposition?
Well, they've been quite consistent. You might recall that there was a ongoing dialogue between the so-called opposition and the government all of last year that was making some progress until they received orders from the U.S. authorities to break off the communication and to take a position in opposition to the election. And so the plan was put in place at that moment, that basically they were going to move in a more aggressive fashion toward Venezuela. So this latest expression with the president of the National Assembly claiming that they are the only legitimate body in the country, and therefore he is the rightful president, was something that was somewhat anticipated. But it wasn't really completely anticipated that they would go in this direction in terms of once again calling out the people or the opposition to call out the people in order to create a crisis that could provide a pretext for direct U.S. intervention. And that's why this situation here is more serious than any other time in the history of Venezuela post 2002. And that's why it's important for there to be some very visible and vocal opposition coming from the people in the United States. We've got to suggest to the Trump administration that there will not be popular support for direct intervention into the affairs of this country, which is quite ironic that people talk about the concerns they have about interventions and meddling by the Russians, supposedly, in the U.S. But here we have this clear example of the U.S. attempting to intervene directly and meddle in the democratic processes of another country. But that's seen as acceptable, not only by the political right, but also apparently by the left.
Ajamu, thank you very much for that point, because that takes me to my next point. Tom, it's important for Americans to understand that Venezuela is now surrounded by right-wing leaders in Colombia and Brazil. Both were supported in, if not put in, by intervention by the U.S. In Venezuela, hyperinflation led Maduro to bring in a new currency, which in recent months has been losing value. More than 3 million Venezuelans have fled the country. All of these problems have been exacerbated, if not caused, by sanctions and other types of intervention and manipulation by the United States. This so-called crisis in Venezuela is not organic. It's, at least as far as I can see, it's been caused by external intervention, which, as Ajamu just very aptly described, the U.S. is so offended by claims that Russia has interfered in U.S. elections, but that's what the United States is doing in Venezuela.
That's what American exceptionalism is. It's a God-given right. You know, economic inequality is an international phenomenon, and it's not a natural phenomenon. People just don't become poor. People are made poor. Economic equality happens when the greedy become even more greedier. One of the things that we have to be concerned about, there's a racial and ethnic component to this, that in Brazil and Colombia and in Venezuela, there are large African populations, and in Brazil and Venezuela, under Hugo Chavez and Lula, there was a movement towards expanding the economic base, uplifting the poor and indigenous and African populations. This is not something that people like Trump or people in America really want. You would think that the Black Caucus would make a statement, but they probably won't. Fascism grows and develops in the midst of chaos. What Trump has been very skillful at is creating chaos around the world.
And I'm calling it controlled chaos.
It is, very definitely. It just says economic inequality is man-made. It's not a natural phenomenon. And so, as Ajamu was saying, the Americans are violating all kinds of international norms while saying, and this comes gets to the Democrats who are really pushing this whole Russian thing for political reasons, not that they're really concerned about Russia interfering in the election, but for political reasons. And so unless the international community speaks up, unless the UN speaks up, this is going to be, as Gerald said, it's going to be chaotic and devastating in Venezuela.
And Gerald, your thoughts as we go into this break.
Well, first of all, let's look at the surrounding neighborhood. In Colombia, one of Venezuela's closest neighbors, we know that a fragile process is still in motion, although there have been some bombings lately, ratcheted up temperatures. There's enormous pressure on the government in Bogota to go along with this radical move in Caracas. And I'm afraid to say it probably won't take that right-wing government much pressure in order to go along. In Ecuador, but that the government there is under enormous pressure to expel Julian Assange from their London embassy and extradite him to the United States of America, which would be a blow in itself. I have to say I'm particularly disappointed, not only with Canada, which apparently does not recognize that the historical moment is changing as Washington seeks to convert erstwhile allies into vassal states, particularly Germany, European Union, which is tending to go along against Maduro, despite the fact Chancellor Merkel herself, quite disrespectfully, an indication of his attempt to convert this powerful nation into a vassal state. And then you mentioned the Congressional Black Caucus as well. Perhaps the CBC does not recognize we're in a different historical moment. Hiding under your desk is no longer an option.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. We are talking about President Nicolas Maduro faced the gravest challenge to his authority since assuming power as the opposition leader Juan Guaido claimed the mantle of leadership, even though Maduro is still the democratically elected president of Venezuela. Maduro has responded by announcing a break in diplomatic and political relations with the United States and ordering American diplomats to leave the country within 72 hours. This is an incredibly perilous, incredibly dangerous situation. Dr. Gerald Horn, Tom Porter, and Ajamu Baraka are my guests. There is more on the other side on this issue. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Crisis in Venezuela. The United States is backing in this play that it actually, I believe, initiated, where opposition leader Juan Guaido has claimed the mantle of leadership in Venezuela. President Maduro has announced a break in diplomatic relations and ordered American diplomats to leave the country within 72 hours. And discussing this, providing some great insight, we've got Dr. Gerald Horn, Tom Porter, and Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu, coming back to you, following up on Tom's point about American exceptionalism, and I'll throw in manifest destiny, and I'll throw in white man's burden into this as well. The U.S. has tried a number of tactics to undermine first former President Hugo Chavez and now Maduro. They tampered with elections. They've tried economic sanctions, diplomatic isolation. And now, if President Maduro does not acquiesce, as Trump said at the General Assembly of the UN, all options are on the table. And we know what that means. The Trump sanctions, built on Obama-era sanctions, identifying Venezuela as a, quote, extraordinary threat to national security, end quote, around the time that Obama initiated a process of normalizing relations with Cuba, he began targeting assets of various senior officials and individuals associated with the Maduro government. Under Obama, the U.S. government continued Bush-era funding to opposition political organizations in Venezuela and lobbied regional governments again and again to censure Venezuela in multilateral organizations like the OAS, the Organization of American States. Obama administration, like the Bush administration before it, which was involved in that 2002 coup against Chavez, they've had a policy of promoting regime change in Venezuela. So I bring all that history in. I'd like you to speak to the fact that to Tom's point, this is not Donald Trump. This is Donald Trump as a functionary of the United States implementing U.S. foreign policy.
Exactly. And that's why I don't get into the politics of personality when it comes to what Trump represents and what the Democrats are representing. But basically, we have to look at these issues and their objective structural forms. Look at the particular interests that are in play. Obama identifying Venezuela as a threat to U.S. national security was quite consistent and made sense. If you connect this to the agenda of U.S. Imperialism what was their guiding document, which is their national security strategy, where they have said that any regional threat to U.S. hegemony would be basically moved against. And so the threat to U.S. hegemony in Latin America was, in fact, the Venezuelan state. So, of course, it becomes a threat to U.S. national security. So the Trump administration is quite consistent in carrying out the objective strategy of the U.S. The problem we face today, though, is that the ability to galvanize opposition is much more difficult because, you know, Dr. Horn talked about the fact that we are in a different historical moment, and we are. And part of that moment that we're in is that the U.S. is now a right-wing society. So when we talk about the Congressional Black Caucus, we've got to remember that we're talking about a much different body today than in 1972, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very dangerous and serious and different situation that we're facing, trying to understand and come to terms with what are the real options that progressive forces have in Venezuela.
Dr. Horn, I found it interesting if we go back to Brazil and President Bolsonaro. He spoke at Davos. Brazil's white right-wing president stressed that protecting his country's unique ecosystem has to be consistent with economic growth. His speech outlined tax cutting, privatization, which we all know as austerity. He pledged to bring about economic change, saying that by the end of his term, Brazil will be in the ranking of the 50 best countries to do business with. And then interestingly enough, he's sitting there having dinner with, or maybe put another way, Apple CEO Tim Cook is having dinner with Bolsonaro, unlikely dining companions since Cook is openly gay. And Bolsonaro is about as homophobic as one could ever be, saying that he would beat kids to prevent them from turning gay. And so I bring Bolsonaro in because Brazil is next to Venezuela. We are seeing an attempt to do in Venezuela what's being done in Brazil. When you look at people like Tim Cook, you would not expect on some levels that he would be involved in a play like this.
Well, I mean, for example, Mr. Bolsonaro ran on the platform in terms of making his policy towards China congruent with that of Mr. Trump, even though China is probably the major trade partner of Brazil. I dare say that he'll be walking back that policy or otherwise shrouding it sooner rather than later. He also talked about emulating Mr. Trump and moving the Brazilian embassy to Jerusalem. There was an outcry in the Arab world. I'm not sure if you can expect that move shortly, but it's not only Brazil that is facing problems right now in light of this new international crisis made in Washington, D.C. I mean, look at small Guyana, a neighbor of Venezuela. The enormous pressure as we speak to join the cabal against Mr. Maduro, not least because there are historic territorial problems between these two neighboring South American countries. However, the situation is going to become more inflamed because Venezuela is not without friends and allies. We've already talked on these airwaves in recent weeks about Mr. Maduro's trip to Moscow within the last few weeks, which he found to be one of the most intriguing meetings that he's ever had on the international scene by his own admission. President Erdogan of Turkey has visited Caracas. we already know about the enormous capital that China has poured into Venezuela. And we also know that there are close relations between Venezuela and Iran. Speaking of Iran, and this speaks to this whole question of why some in our community have not been more aggressive on the foreign policy front, even though the moment historically has changed, because I guess they still think that we're in the Cold War moment where the black organizations basically cut a deal with U.S. imperialism where they would receive anti-Jim Crow concessions in return for not speaking out aggressively on foreign policy. Well, that time is up. That time is over. And I'm afraid to say that even those who consider themselves to be militant do not realize that. And I say that also because of a related issue. I'm sure you know about the case of the woman now wasting away in a Washington, D.C. jail.
Absolutely.
Franklin, who migrated to Iran, became a commentator on press TV, and now is being treated very harshly in Washington after she came back to visit her family. Where is the outcry from the Congressional Black Caucus, the NAACP, even the militant Muslim community in Washington, D.C.? Don't they realize that we're in a dangerous moment right now and that to remain silent is basically betrayal?
I think it's also important to mention that Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa just recently went to Russia and met there.
Well, sure. I mean, I think the latest news on that front, which we all are going to have to consider very carefully, is that according to recent press reports, Russia is in the process of passing Germany as the world's fifth largest economy. Despite the sanctions, despite the devilment involved in U.S. policy towards Russia, this is having enormous consequence for the global correlation of forces. But I don't think that even those within the U.S. left have taken this into account.
Tom, to Gerald's point about friends that Venezuela has, a lot of people don't remember the Petrocaribe Initiative and how Venezuela became incredibly popular in Central America and the Caribbean, thanks in great parts to this very generous Petrocaribe Initiative, which brought serious economic benefits to a lot of countries in the region.
Well, you're absolutely right. And that's something that the United States and other reactionary governments around the world want to terminate, just as they want to terminate Cuba, sending doctors all over the world and educators all over the world. But Gerald is so right when he not only speaks to the fact that Venezuela has friends, there's a realignment of forces going on in the world today, and you don't always see it. But there are different relationships that countries are beginning to have with each other, because I think for the most part, America is not viewed as a reliable ally. So it's not viewed as a reliable ally. And so you see the movement of China. China is very active in Latin and Central America. Very active in Latin and Central America.
And African countries as well.
And after you're right. And so there's a realignment of forces. And the problem with Americans, and that's black Americans as well, they're caught up in this notion of American exceptionalism. I mean, a lot of black folks, they see this as the best of all possible worlds, but they don't really recognize this realignment of forces. It's not just China, but it's Asian countries, it's African countries. And then you got a world full of young people who are very much concerned about the environment, about education, what have you, not afraid of the word communism. I mean, if free public education is communism, then I want it. So that's not really working anymore. Got to pay attention to this realignment of force. I'm so glad, Gerald, that you mentioned those relationships, because that's so important in today's world.
Ajamu, in looking at how this is playing out, for me, we've seen this movie too many times. You've got the illegal operations of ExxonMobil in the territorial waters of Essequibo, Guyana, which I think Gerald was referring to, the economic and financial embargo that was applied not only by the U.S., but also by the European Union. But we saw this game in 1953 in Iran with the coup that was led by Anglo-Iranian Oil, which is now a part of British Petroleum, that led to the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh. We saw it in 1954 in Guatemala with the United Fruit Company, which is now, I think, Chiquita Brands, getting the CIA to overthrow Arbenz. We've seen this game, we've seen this movie so many times. And so to Tom's point and to Gerald's point and to the point, where are so-called progressives on this thing?
You know, the progressives have moved to the right, both in the U.S. and throughout Western Europe. And therefore, there's political cover for these kinds of reactionary policies. So we have a very difficult task. I mean, even something as what we would think people would be opposed to, that is NATO, we are finding that there's significant support among the general population. We just found out about NATO 2 weeks ago, but they are in support of NATO because Trump is opposed to it, supposedly. But, you know, so we have some real serious political educational challenges before us if we're going to really build an effective opposition. And one thing that is going to happen, I think, in Venezuela and throughout Latin America is that even if there is a shift in government in Venezuela, we know that the right-wing elements cannot be successful because they have no alternative. All they can present to the people will be a neoliberal option. And it's neoliberalism that created the conditions that brought Chavez and the revolutionary process into play. So, you know, while the conditions are fundamentally different, they are very dangerous, and we're going to see quite in the next few days what's really going to play out in Venezuela and really throughout Latin America. That's going to be key.
We have just about 4 minutes left, and so, Gerald, I'll start with you. Anything in this analysis in terms of where we are in this process right now that I overlooked that you want to be sure people understand?
Well, first of all, the incoherence policy on the one hand, Mr. Trump is clamoring against immigration, legal and otherwise. And at the same time, he's creating conditions in Latin America, particularly in Venezuela, that's going to be driving people into South Florida in droves. And in fact, there's a substantial Venezuelan population already in Miami. And with regard to this movement in the United States of America, many have pointed to the fact that in other countries, that 800,000 workers were locked out, which is basically what's happening. There'd be protests in the streets, there'd be demonstrations, perhaps there would even be riots. The question we should ask ourselves is, why hasn't that taken place in the United States of America? And I think the answer is rather simple. During the Cold War period, labor unions and class-based organizations were weakened, which was a precondition to the rise of a right-wing foreign policy, which is still with us today. Therefore, all of these issues are linked and interlinked.
Tom Porter, we have about a minute and a half. Same question to you.
Well, I think it's important to understand what the role of sanctions are. The role of sanctions are to create a situation among the people so that their economic situation is so bad that they will rise up against the leaders. The unfortunate thing for the right-wing governments is that the people rising up against Maduro are not the working class in Venezuela. They're basically largely white Venezuelans. Who I used to have a Venezuelan woman who roomed in my house, and she was right-wing, nice woman, still calls me and texts me about how bad things are. But she was upset about the fact that Chavez was empowering people of African descent. So all those people who have left, the people who are going to be left in Venezuela is going to be Maduro's base, how he organizes them, how he puts together resistance. He's going to have to resist. If he doesn't do that, he can't worry about being called oppressive. He's got to beat them back.
Ajamu, 30 seconds.
It's a very difficult situation in Venezuela. Trying to address those contradictions when you have a shaky social base that what we see in Venezuela is very, very difficult. We are hoping that they're going to be able to withstand this pressure. Again, for me, the key is going to be to what degree we can generate support outside of Venezuela to try to put a brake on U.S. interventionism. That's going to be absolutely key for whether or not the Venezuelan process is going to be able to survive this period.
Ajamu Baraka, Tom Porter, Dr. Gerald Horn, thank all three of you for such short notice and coming on board to the Critical Hour. Greatly, greatly appreciated. Folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. In the wake of the Los Angeles teachers' strike ending, as United Teachers Los Angeles says, its members overwhelmingly supported a new contract agreement with the LA Unified School District. The union and the school board must still officially ratify the pact after another Western school district is set to go out on strike. After more than a year of tense negotiations with the school district, Denver teachers overwhelmingly voted to strike late yesterday. Following 2 days of voting, the Denver Classroom Teachers Association announced that 93% of its members approved a strike after negotiations failed. Quote, Denver teachers overwhelmingly agreed to strike, lead negotiator Rob Gould said during a press conference yesterday. Members of the DCTA have begun meeting to make signs, write chants, and practice picketing, according to CNN affiliate KDVR. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is president of Denver Classroom Teachers Association, DCTA. They have nearly 3,000 members representing more than 5,600 educators throughout Denver Public Schools. He is President Henry Roman. Henry, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Now, as I understand it, schools open today, but the strike could happen as soon as Monday the 28th. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. That's the tentative date right now. We are having a meeting. We're meeting with the governor, and we'll have a clear idea about next steps after that meeting.
And what is the basic premise of the meeting with the governor? I know, for example, in Los Angeles, initially they had planned to strike one day, but were concerned about notification requirements in their contract, and they wanted to be sure that they in no way violated their contract, so they postponed their walkout date to be sure that they did not violate any terms of their contract. So what are the issues or what's the basis of the conversation with the governor?
One is to clarify, like you said, that we're following the process correctly, and we believe we are. They require a 20-day notification process, and that was on January 8th. So some basic math, January 28th. Based on that, it seems that we are on the right track in terms of process. Obviously, it's a little bit more nuanced because we are not, DCTA is not asking for any kind of intervention from the state or the governor. However, the district might want to do that. And if they do, then what happens is it gives a chance to the state or the governor to issue a response and say, you know, we're going to assess the situation, or we decided not to intervene because we have reviewed your case and we know that you have done everything possible.
The union has been negotiating with the school district for 14 months to overhaul the compensation system, which the union says is directly linked to the city's teacher turnover rate. Is pay at the crux of this issue?
Yes, it is. The current way teachers, Denver teachers, are paid is by this system called ProComp. And ProComp is largely comprised of one-time incentives that are mostly determined by factors outside of the educator's control. This means our teachers in Denver have to rely heavily on variable pay that decreases over time. And that's one of the main reasons why we see huge numbers of educators leaving Denver.
Wait a minute. When you say pay decreasing over time. Does that mean the longer you're in the system, the more years you have in the classroom, the less money you make?
Exactly. And it's a little bit nuanced in the sense of...
That sounds quite regressive to me, to say the least.
It is. It is regressive, and it's quite an experience if you're working here. So what happens is, you know, the district relies heavily on one-time incentives. And one of the things that have been happening is they've been decreasing those incentives over time. So when you look at your earnings from year to year, you actually see a decrease, not an increase. And what the problem with one-time incentives is that it does mask how much you're actually making in base. That's why we are proposing a salary system like a traditional salary schedule like every other district in Colorado. It's pretty standard, that it's easy to understand, easy to figure out, you know, years of experience plus level of education, that more or less tells you where you are at. So that's what we're proposing the district right now. And they have come up with something that looks like a salary schedule, but I think they need to do more work on that.
So the Los Angeles teachers were dealing with issues, salary plus other issues such as overcrowded classrooms, schools without nurses, schools without librarians. Are you facing similar issues in Denver, or are those issues not nearly as important to the classroom as compensation is at this point?
They are very important, and those are issues that we'll be able to have conversations after we finish this round of negotiations about teacher compensation, because our contract is bifurcated. One part of the contract is the master agreement with all the things that you just mentioned, and the other part of the contract is mainly about teacher pay. So the one we're dealing right now is around teacher compensation, but the structure has been so bad that it's about time for us to have something that is more standard with every other district in Colorado.
And where is Denver as it relates to its tax base and as it relates to funding sources for schools?
Right. No, we have a booming economy. This is one of the best times to be in Colorado if you are not in education. and basically, we do have the resources and the funding. But we have something very unique in Colorado called TABOR. And TABOR is a measure that basically returns any additional tax revenues to the voters, to the taxpayers. That's something that needs to be modified. It seemed like a really good idea back, you know, more than a decade ago, but it has had horrible consequences for funding in general, and specifically education and transportation and many other issues in the state.
So if I understand that, what you're saying is unused tax revenue in 1 year gets returned back to the taxpayer.
Yep.
So yes. Developing...
There's no money for a rainy day.
That's what I was trying to get to. There's no rainy day fund. There's no basic money in the bank. Are you all doing zero-based budgeting every year?
neutral budgeting, maybe. No, I mean, what we're trying to do is make sure that we always have some sort of balanced budget, but it's increasingly hard. However, in spite of that, Denver is the largest, DPS is the largest school district in Colorado, and we do have quite a significant budget. And we strongly believe that funding is not allocated properly and not especially to where it's needed. For example, I mean, we do know, and this is a fact, that teachers in general, educators in Colorado in general, spent on average about $750 out of pocket to buy basic school supplies. While at this time, right now, the DPS administration is spending $4 million on bonuses for administrators that are making $100,000 plus. So it just doesn't make any sense. The optics, the everything on that doesn't make sense. That's money that is better spent going back to the classrooms and to teacher compensation.
I got you. You mentioned that Denver has the largest budget in Colorado. Where are some of the other school districts as it relates to their compensation packages and their willingness to strike or support your strike? What I meant was strike on their own behalf or walk out in support of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association.
They're very sympathetic. They're okay. Very sympathetic to our cause. They know why we're doing it. And they also know that our neighboring districts know that they are also offering competitive pay. That's one of the reasons why Denver is, you know, so far behind, and we're basically trying to catch up with them and make sure that we offer also competitive pay so we can attract and retain educators in Colorado, and also that we can offer a higher base so educators or teachers can live in where they work, basically.
I'm trying to get a sense now on looking at what happened in Los Angeles and now Denver. I think Oregon might be discussing this as well. If we look at this in a national context, are we starting to see a move where teachers and school districts are striking? And are you getting any sense of what this means? Is there a rise in the strength of unions in this country?
I believe so. I mean, school funding is becoming something that people are becoming more and more aware, especially because, you know, it's such an important investment in the future of your state or in the future of the nation. So we need to ensure that schools are properly funded. And once you do that basic comparison from state to state to the national level at the national average, you realize there are many, many places, many, many states that are not keeping up with what's needed in terms of infrastructure spending, in terms of compensation for educators. All of those things are some serious issues. And just like you mentioned, what's happening in LA, you know, support services like social worker, nurses, psychologists, all of them, you know, are part of what makes a good school, you know. So class size, it's another big issue. And all of those, in one way or another, have also to do not only the way the district manages their budget, but also in terms of statewide, how is the school funding allocated? And there's always, you know, some sort of tension between all of the other needs that the state has. But obviously, a K-12 funding happens to be one of the big budget items in most states.
Final question to you. Where is Denver as it relates to charter schools? Are charter schools a real issue? It sounds like they are.
It is a huge, massive issue in Colorado. Just to give you some sense of context, we have about 160 schools, but 80 of those, in addition to the 160, 80 are charter schools. So if you were to add all of the other charter schools you have in all of the other districts in Colorado, you would maybe make up, you know, 10. We have 8 times more than the entire state.
And are the charter school teachers on the same pay scale as?
No, they're not. They're not. They have their own boards. They set their own salaries, and their salaries are significantly lower. And what's interesting about what you just mentioned is that now that we are in the process of having a potential strike, all of the different charter networks in Denver are having impromptu, you know, conversations with their staff and their teachers saying, we've heard, you know, that, you know, compensation is an issue. We're planning to increase next year this much more. So they are all kind of, it's having sort of like a ripple effect, and they are offering increases, unannounced increases to many of the teachers in charter schools, which is an interesting development.
Wow. Well, Mr. Henry Roman, president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association, thank you so much. I know you're on your way into some meetings, so thank you so much for giving us time today. And hopefully we're going to track this over the weekend and look forward to possibly having you back on Monday the 28th if the strike actually happens.
Well, thank you. Thank you for reaching out, and I appreciate your interest.
Thank you, sir. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
Take care. You too. Oh, wow. Okay, folks. Well, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.